It was dim in the Garrick Theatre, dusty and cold, with the pit and the balcony and the racks of shabby seats, but it was pitch dark below the stage where Mick Radley was, and it smelled of damp and lime. Mick's voice echoed up from under her feet. "Ever seen the innards of a kinotrope, Sybil?"
"I saw one once, backstage," she said, "at a music hall in Bethnal Green. I knew the fellow what worked it, a clacker cove."
"A sweetheart?" Mick asked. His echoing voice was sharp.
"No," Sybil told him quickly. "I was singing a bit, but it scarcely paid."
She heard the sharp click of his repeating match. It caught on the third attempt, and he lit a stub of candle. "Come down," he commanded. "Don't stand there like a goose showing off your ankles." Sybil lifted her crinoline with both hands and picked her way uneasily down the steep, damp stairs. Mick reached up to grope behind a tall stage mirror, a great gleaming sheet of silvered glass, with a wheeled pedestal and oily gears and worn wooden cranks. He retrieved a cheap black portmanteau of proofed canvas, placed it carefully on the floor before him, and squatted to undo the flimsy tin clasps. He removed a stack of perforated cards bound with a ribbon of red paper. There were other bundles in the bag as well, Sybil saw, and something else, a gleam of polished wood. He handled the cards gently, like a Bible. "Safe as houses," he said. "You just disguise 'em, you see. Write something stupid on the wrapper like, 'Temperance Lecture, Parts 1, 2, 3. Then coves never think to steal 'em, or even load them up and look." Hefting the thick block, he riffled its edge with his thumb so that it made a sharp, crisp sound like a gambler's new deck. "I put a deal of capital in these," he said. "Weeks of work from the best kino hands in Manchester. Exclusive to my design, I might point out. 'Tis a lovely thing, girl. Quite artistic in its way. You'll soon see." Closing the portmanteau, he stood. He carefully slid the bundle of cards into his coat pocket, then bent over a crate and tugged out a thick glass tube. He blew dust from the tube, then gripped one end of it with a special pair of pincers. The glass cracked open with an airtight pop. There was a fresh block of lime in the tube. Mick slid it loose, humming to himself. He tapped the lime gently into the socket of a limelight burner, a great dish-shaped thing of sooty iron and gleaming tin. Then he turned a hose tap, sniffed a bit, nodded, turned a second tap, and set the candle to it. Sybil yelped as a vicious flash sheeted into her eyes. Mick chuckled at her over the hiss of blazing gas, dots of hot blue dazzle drifting before her. "Better," he remarked. He aimed the blazing limelight carefully into the stage mirror, then began to adjust its cranks. Sybil looked around, blinking. It was dank and ratty and cramped under the Garrick stage, the sort of place a dog or a pauper might die in, with torn and yellowed bills underfoot for naughty farces like That Rascal Jack and Scamps of London. A pair of ladies' unmentionables were wadded in a corner. From her brief, unhappy days as a stage singer, she had some idea how they might have gotten there. She let her gaze follow steam pipes and taut wires to the gleam of the Babbage engine, a small one, a kinotrope model no taller than Sybil herself. Unlike everything else in the Garrick, the engine looked in very good repair, mounted on 4 mahogany blocks. The floor and ceiling above and beneath it had been carefully scoured and whitewashed. Steam calculators were delicate things, temperamental, so she'd heard. Better not to own one than not cherish it. In the stray glare from Mick's limelight, dozens of knobbed brass columns gleamed, set top and bottom into solid sockets bored through polished plates, with shining levers, ratchets, 1,000 steel gears cut bright and fine. It smelled of linseed oil. Looking at it, this close, this long, made Sybil feel quite odd. Hungry, almost, or greedy in a queer way, the way she might feel about a fine lovely horse, say. She wanted not to own it exactly, but possess it somehow. Mick took her elbow suddenly from behind. She started.
"Lovely thing, isn't it?"
"Yes, it's lovely."
Mick still held her arm. Slowly he put his other gloved hand against her cheek inside her bonnet. Then he lifted her chin with his thumb, stared into her face.
"It makes you feel something, doesn't it?"
His rapt voice frightened her, his eyes underlit with glare.
"Yes, Mick," she said obediently, quickly. "I do feel it. Something."
He tugged her bonnet loose to hang at her neck.
"You're not frightened of it, Sybil, are you? Not with Dandy Mick here holding you. You feel a little special frisson. You'll learn to like that feeling. We'll make a clacker of you."
"Can I do that? Truly, can a girl do that?"
Mick laughed.
"Have you never heard of Lady Ada Byron, then? The Prime Minister's daughter and the very Queen of Engines."
He let her go and swung both his arms wide, coat swinging open, a showman's gesture.
"Ada Byron, true friend and disciple of Babbage himself, Lord Charles Babbage, father of the difference engine and the Newton of our modern age."
She gaped at him. "But Ada Byron is a ladyship."
"You'll be surprised who our Lady Ada knows,"
Mick declared, plucking a block of cards from his pocket and peeling off its paper jacket.
"Oh, not to drink tea with among the diamond squad at her garden parties, but Ada's what you'd call fast in her own mathematical way."
He paused.
"That's not to say that Ada is the best, you know. I know clacking coves in the Steam Intellect Society that make even Lady Ada look a bit tardy, but Ada possesses genius. Do you know what that means, Sybil, to possess genius?"
"What?"
Sybil said, hating the giddy surety in his voice.
"Do you know how analytical geometry was born? Fellow named Descartes, watching a fly on the ceiling. A million fellows before him had watched flies on the ceiling, but it took René Descartes to make a science of it. Now engineers use what he discovered every day, but if it weren't for him, we'd still be blind to it."
"What do flies matter to anyone?" Sybil demanded.
"Ada had an insight once that ranked with Descartes' discovery. No one has found a use for it as yet. It's what they call pure mathematics."
Mick laughed.
"Pure? You know what that means, Sybil? It means they can't get it to run."
He rubbed his hands together, grinning.
"No one can get it to run."
Mick's glee was wearing at her nerves.
"I thought you hated lordships."
"I do hate lordly privilege. What's not earned fair and square and level," he said. "But Lady Ada lives and swears by the power of the grey matter, and not her blue blood."
He slotted the cards into a silvered tray by the side of the machine, then spun and caught her wrist.
"Your father's dead, girl. 'Tis not that I mean to hurt you, saying it, but the Luddites are dead as cold ashes. Oh, we marched and ranted for the rights of labour and such. Fine talk, girl. But Lord Charles Babbage made blueprints while we made pamphlets, and his blueprints built this world."
Mick shook his head.
"The Byron men, the Babbage men, the industrial radicals, they own Great Britain. They own us, girl. The very globe is at their feet, Europe, America, everywhere. The House of Lords is packed top to bottom with rads. Queen Victoria won't stir a finger without a nod from the savants and capitalists."
He pointed at her.
"And it's no use fighting that any more. And you know why? 'Cause the rads do play fair, or fair enough to manage, and you can become one of 'em if you're clever. You can't get clever men to fight such a system, as it makes too much sense to 'em."
Mick thumbed his chest.
"But that don't mean that you and I are out in the cold and lonely. It only means we have to think faster, with our eyes peeled and our ears open."
Mick struck a prize-fighter's pose, elbows bent, fists poised, knuckles up before his face. Then he flung his hair back and grinned at her.
"That's all very well for you," Sybil protested. "You can do as you like. You were one of my father's followers. Well, there were many such, and some are in Parliament now. But fallen women get ruined, do you see? Ruined and stay that way."
Mick straightened, frowning at her.
"Now that's exactly what I mean. You're running with a flash mob now, but thinking like a trollop. There's no one knows who you are in Paris. The cops and bosses have your number here, true enough, but numbers are only that, and your file's no more than a simple stack of cards. For them as know, there's ways to change a number."
He sneered to see her surprise.
"It ain't done easy here in London, I grant you. But affairs run differently in the Paris of Louis Napoleon. Affairs run fast and loose in Flash Paris, especially for an adventuress with a blarney tongue and a pretty ankle."
Sybil bit her knuckle. Her eyes burned suddenly. It was acrid smoke from the limelight and fear. A new number in the government's machines, that would mean a new life, a life without a past. The unexpected thought of such freedom terrified her. Not so much for what it meant in itself, though that was strange and dazzling enough, but for what Mick Radley might demand for such a thing in fair exchange.
Truly, could you change my number?
I can buy you a new one in Paris, pass you off a French, or an Argy, or an American refugee girl. Mick folded his elegant arms. I promise nothing, mind you. You'll have to earn it.
You wouldn't gull me, Mick, she said slowly, because I could be really and specially sweet to a fellow who could do me such a great service.
Mick jammed his hands in his pockets, rocking back on his heels, looking at her.
Could you now? He said softly.
Her trembling words had fanned something inside him. She could see it in his eyes. An eager, lustful kindling, something she dimly knew was there, a need he had to slip his fish-hooks deeper into her.
I could, if you treated me fair and level as your prentice adventuress and not some cakey dolly-mop to gull and cast aside.
Sybil felt tears coming, harder this time. She blinked and looked up boldly and let them flow, thinking perhaps they might do some good.
You wouldn't raise my hopes and dash them, would you? That would be low and cruel. If you did that, I'd jump off Tower Bridge.
He looked her in the eye.
Bah, that sniffling girl, and listen close to me. Understand this? You're not just Mick's pretty bit of muslin. I may have a taste for that same as any man, but I can get that where I like, and don't need you just for that. I need the blarney skill and the daring pluck that was Mr. Walter Gerard's. You ought to be my prentice, Sybil, and I your master, and let that be how things stand with us. You'll be loyal, obedient, truthful to me, no subterfuge and no impertinence, and in return I'll teach you craft and keep you well. And you'll find me as kind and generous as you are loyal and true. Do I make myself clear?
Yes, Mick.
We have a pact, then?
Yes, Mick.
She smiled at him.
Well and good, he said. Then kneel, here, and put your hands together. So,
he joined his hands in prayer, and make this oath, that you, Sybil Gerard, do swear by saints and angels, by powers, dominions and thrones, by seraphim and cherubim, and the all-seeing eye, to obey Michael Radley, and serve him faithfully. So help you God. Do you so swear?
She stared at him in dismay. Must I really?
Yes.
But isn't it a great sin to make such an oath to a man who... I mean to say, we're not in holy wedlock.
That's a marriage vow, he said impatiently, and this apprentice oath.
She saw no alternative. Tugging her skirts back, she knelt before him on cold, gritty stone.
Do you so swear?
I do. So help me God.
Don't look so glum, he said, helping her to her feet. That's a mild and womanly oath you swore compared to some.
He pulled her to her feet.
Let it brace you, should you have doubts or disloyal thoughts. Now, take this, he handed her the guttering candle, and hunt up that gin-soak of a stage manager, and tell him I want the boilers fired.
They dined that evening in the Argyle Rooms, a Haymarket resort not far from Laurent's Dancing Academy. The Argyle had private supper rooms in which the indiscreet might spend an entire night. Sybil was mystified by the choice of a private room. Mick was certainly not ashamed to be seen with her in public. Midway through the lamb, however, the waiter admitted a stout little gentleman with pomaded red hair and a gold chain across a taut velvet waistcoat. He was round and plush as a child's doll.
"Hello, Corny," Mick said, without bothering to put down his knife and fork. "Evening, Mick," the man said, with a curiously unplaceable accent of an actor, or a provincial long in service to city gentry. "I was told you'd need of me."
"And told correctly, Corny,"
Mick neither offered to introduce Sybil nor asked the man to sit. She began to feel quite uncomfortable.
"'Tis a brief part, so you should have little trouble remembering your lines."
Mick produced a plain envelope from his coat and handed it to the man.
"Your lines, your cue, and your retainer. The Garrick, Saturday night."
The man smiled mirthlessly as he accepted the envelope.
"Quite some time since I played the Garrick, Mick."
He winked at Sybil and took his leave, with no more formality than that.
"Who's that, Mick?"
Sybil asked. Mick had returned to his lamb and was spooning mint sauce from a pewter serving pot.
"An actor of parts," Mick said. "He'll play opposite you in the Garrick during Houston's speech."
Sybil was baffled. "Play? Opposite me?"
"Your apprentice adventuress, don't forget. You can expect to be called on to play many roles, Sybil. A political speech can always benefit from a bit of sweetening."
"Sweetening?"
"Never mind." He seemed to lose interest in his lamb and pushed his plate aside. "Plenty of time for rehearsal tomorrow. I've something to show you now."
He rose from the table, crossed to the door and bolted it securely. Returning, he lifted the proofed canvas portmanteau from the carpet beside his chair and placed it before her on the Argyle's clean but much mended linen. She'd been curious about the portmanteau. Not curious that he'd carried it with him from the Garrick's pit, first to the printer's, to examine the handbills for Houston's lecture, then on to the Argyle rooms, but because it was of such cheap stuff, nothing at all like the gear he so obviously prided himself on. Why should Dandy Mick choose to carry about a bag of that sort, when he could afford some flash confection from Aaron's, nickel clasps and silk woven in Ada checkers? And she knew that the black bag no longer contained the keynote cards for the lecture, because he'd wrapped those carefully in sheets of The Times and hidden them again behind the stage mirror. Mick undid the wretched tin clasps, opened the bag, and lifted out a long narrow case of polished rosewood, its corners trimmed with bright brass. Sybil wondered if it mightn't contain a telescope, for she'd seen boxes of this sort in the window of a firm of Oxford Street instrument makers. Mick handled it with a caution that was very nearly comical, like some papist called upon to move the dust of a dead pope. Caught up in a sudden mood of childlike anticipation, she forgot the man called Corny and Mick's worrying talk about playing opposite him at the Garrick. There was something of the magician about Mick now, as he placed the gleaming rosewood case on the tablecloth. She almost expected him to furl back his cuffs. "Nothing here, you see, nothing here." His thumbs swung tiny brass hooks from a pair of miniature eyelets. He paused for effect. Sybil found that she was holding her breath. Had he brought a gift for her? Some token of her new status? Something to secretly mark her as his prentice adventuress? Mick lifted the rosewood lid with its sharp brass corners. It was filled with playing cards, stuffed end to end with them, a score of decks at the least. Sybil's heart fell.
"You've seen nothing like this before," he said. "I can assure you of that."
Mick pinched out the card nearest his right hand and displayed it for her. No, not a playing card, though near enough in size. It was made of some strange milky substance that was neither paper nor glass, very thin and glossy. Mick flexed it lightly between thumb and forefinger. It bent easily, but sprang rigid again as he released it. It was perforated with perhaps 36 tightly spaced rows of circular holes, holes no larger than those in a good pearl button. Three of its corners were slightly rounded, while the fourth was trimmed off at an angle. Near the trimmed corner someone had written, "Number 1," in faint mauve ink.
"Camphorated cellulose," Mick declared. "The devil's own stuff should it touch fire. But naught else will serve the finer functions of the Napoleon."
Napoleon? Sybil was lost. "Is it a sort of keynote card, Mick?"
He beamed at her, delighted. She seemed to have said the right thing.
"Have you never heard of the great Napoleon Ordinateur, the mightiest engine of the French Academy? The London police engines are mere toys beside it."
Sybil pretended to study the contents of the box, knowing it would please Mick, but it was merely a wooden box, quite handsomely made, lined with a green baize that covered billiard tables. It contained a very large quantity of the slick, milky cards, perhaps several hundred.
"Tell me what this is about, Mick."
He laughed, quite happily it seemed, and bent suddenly to kiss her mouth.
In time...
He straightened, reinserted the card, lowered the lid, clicked the brass hooks into place.
"Every brotherhood has its mysteries. Dandy Mick's best guess is that nobody knows quite what it would mean to run this little stack. It would demonstrate a certain matter, prove a certain nested series of mathematical hypotheses, all matters quite arcane. And, by the by, it would make the name of Michael Radley shine like the very heavens in the clacking confraternity."
He winked.
"The French clackers have their own brotherhoods, you know. Les filles de Vaucanson, they call themselves.
the Jacquardine Society. We'll be showing those onion eaters a thing or two."
He seemed drunk to her now, though she knew he'd only had those two bottled ales. No, he was intoxicated by the idea of the cards in the box, whatever they might be.
"This box and its contents are quite extraordinarily dear, Sybil."
He seated himself again and rummaged in the cheap black bag. It yielded a folded sheet of stout brown paper, an ordinary pair of stationary shears, a roll of strong green twine. As Mick spoke, he unfolded the paper and began to wrap the box in it.
"Very dear. Travelling with a general exposes a man to certain dangers. We're off to Paris after the lecture, but tomorrow morning you'll be taking this round to the post office in Great Portland Street."
Done with wrapping, he wound twine about the paper.
"Nip this for me with the shears."
She did as he asked.
"Now put your finger here."
He executed a perfect knot.
"You'll be posting our parcel to Paris. Post restant. Do you know what that means?"
"It means the parcel is held for the addressee."
Mick nodded, took a stick of scarlet sealing wax from one trouser pocket, his repeating match from the other. The match struck on the first try.
"Yes. Held there in Paris for us. Safe as houses."
The wax darkened and slid in the oily flame. Scarlet droplets spattered the green knot, the brown paper. He tossed the shears and the roll of twine back into the portmanteau, pocketed the wax and the match, withdrew his reservoir pen, and began to address the parcel.
"But what is it, Mick? How can you know its value if you've no idea what it does?"
"Now, I didn't say that, did I? I've my ideas, don't I? Dandy Mick always has his ideas. I'd enough of an idea to take the original up to Manchester with me on the General's business. I'd enough of an idea to pump the canniest clackers for their latest compression techniques, and enough of the General's capital to commission the result on Napoleon gauge cellulose."
It might have been Greek, for all it meant to her.